The DigitalLifestyle.com presents The Media Centre Show, Thursday, 9th of August 2007, Show 118. Sense Show, the Orb Networks. I'm Ian Dixon, and this week on the show I have founder of Digital Media Thoughts, blogger and Media Center enthusiast Jason Dunn joining me to talk about his experiences with Windows Media Center and issues he had, such as album art problems. We'll also be talking about Zune and find out why he scanned hundreds of album covers into his PC. I have comments from the blog and news items. It's great to have you along listening to the show. I've got a good show for you this week, and Jason is really good to talk to. And before I start, I just want to mention the email address for the show is ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. Please keep your emails coming. And this week I thought I would read out some of the comments on the blogs about last week's show, and it's always great to get your feedback. So first up, a comment regarding last week's show with Todd Bowra, and this comment said, "Hi Ian, great show. Nice to hear that Microsoft is working on V2 extenders, and that it will be up to the device manufacturers to implement decoding of various formats, DivX, etc. Before listening to the show this week, I was a bit worried that Microsoft didn't really want to work on new V2 extenders until everybody owned an Xbox 360. Sounds like there is light at the end of the tunnel, though." Thanks for that comment. Yeah, it is nice to know that the V2 extenders are coming. As I've mentioned previously, I'm happy with my 360, but I know a lot of people want a dedicated device, and so I can't wait to see what these V2 extenders look like and how they compare to the 360, because at the end of the day, the 360 is kind of a subsidized device, with all the games console manufacturers kind of subsidizing the cost of the devices made up by the game. So if you're an Xbox 360 owner using it for just Media Center, the other gamers are actually kind of subsidizing your extender usage. But I know a lot of people want the hardware independent devices. So thanks for that comment, and please keep the comments coming in. You may remember two shows back, I asked what plugins and add-ons you'd like to use. In Media Center, and I did get some great feedback, and from the blog over on the green button, from my own blog, and from the thread on the forums. And this one came from the blog on the green button from Ghost Lobster, and he said that the application he could not live without is DVRMS Toolbox. Amanda said My Movies was an essential application, and John Bybin said My Movies as well. A common thread through all the different areas that I've seen these now, My Movies and DVRMS Toolbox are definitely ones that everybody mentions as essential. And have a look back at the comments and you'll see there are other applications that they were interested in being developed. But today I'll just talk about the ones that are essential. Richard Miller over on the DigitalLifestyle.com forum thread that I created said MCE Weather and My Movies, and again you can see My Movies coming here. Samuel said Web Guide, which is definitely my one of my essential ones, mainly for, I use this for remote scheduling, but of course it's got all the, you know, you can use it for streaming, playback and all that kind of thing as well. It's a software extender almost. So check out the thread and see the other comments. It looks like there are a lot of common applications that are essential for Media Center users, and interesting to see some of the things that people are looking for that isn't already out there, and I'll talk about that next week. So if you want to add to that, there's a thread on the forums that you can continue adding your comments, so keep that coming. I'll talk about that again on a future show. Now to some news items. First up, Microsoft last week published a case study of the Showtime application for Vista Media Center. This is the great Media Center application that comes in the US version of Media Center. The Showtime application shows off some of the great sort of premium content that Showtime have and how you can use it interactively within Media Center. It's a great looking user interface, and it makes use of the latest Media Center development technology, Media Center presentation layer. So it's a proper rich application, proper true Vista Media Center application. And it's great to see the case study there, and it's good to see how a big company are looking at Media Center as a platform, and that's what we want, isn't it? We want to see more Media Center applications, not just by being developed by enthusiasts, but by the big content providers as well. So have a look at the case study. In fact, I got a comment about the case study on the blog from ShadyMG, and he said, "Hey, they do look great. You might want to remind your listeners of the review I did a while back for the Showtime plugin for Vista Media Center over at Missing Remote, if they want any more screenshots of information." It's a good point for that. If you've not got Showtime up and running, have a look at the screenshots, and you can see that it's a nice, rich application. And talking of really rich applications, the next application the next news item I wanted to talk about is another Media Center markup language application, but a totally different direction. This is called Squirrel Stash for Windows Media Center. And if you've ever wanted to password protect your content in Media Center, and then Squirrel Stash is the application that you might be interested in. It's a Vista Media Center application, like I said before, Media Center markup language, so it's kind of that rich experience. And it helps you keep a stash of secure content. So basically, you've got a Windows interface where you can create a stash, as they're called in this program. You put content in there, it's password protected, and then you access the content through the Media Center and through the rich interface, and you can put the password in through there and get up the secure content. So it could be music, videos, or whatever you want. And you know, there are different reasons why people want to keep that content separate, you know, and securely locked away. I'll leave you to your imagination to come up with the different scenarios. And the other thing to say as well, that it does run on the Xbox 360 extended sessions as well, which is one of the great things about these new style of applications, that they all run very well on them, and that's really important. There are two versions of Squirrel Stash. There's a free gig limited size version and a $30 unlimited size version. And you can get more information for that from squirrelstash.com. I actually am just in the process of trying the free version at the moment, and it lets you browse for a location on your machine and create your stash file, and you can password protect it, and it's really easy to use the remote control when you're in the Media Center UI to get at the password. You know, it's not difficult, because that's one of the things I always found difficult with something like an email program, is you've got to enter your password every time. It is tricky, but this program does it very nicely. And again, talking of Media Center development, over on the Media Center Sandbox blog, Charlie Owen has posted details of an update on the software development kit for the Vista version of Media Center. And the SDK has the following changes. The Windows Media Center application step-by-step document, which helps you create a Windows Media application from an empty project using Media Center markup language, C#, and the Windows installer. A C# project template has been revised and now includes the Windows installer XML Wix 3.0 script for generating a setup program to install these applications. The MCML file template is revised to work better with the C# project template and includes the basic properties, locals, rules, contents, elements typically needed. And a Visual Studio solution for the MCML sampler, making it easier to search, copy and paste from the markup and the code files. So these changes look like they're encouraging more people to get started with Media Center markup language, and you can see they've got some templates on there. So download the SDK from the link in the show notes, and really interesting to see if anybody takes up development from Media Center markup language and Vista Media Center. There's a lot of good resources out there. There's the developer blog on the digitallifestyle.com and the forums, and then there's Media Center Sandbox, the blog, and their forums as well. So it's definitely worth having a look at those if you're going starting on development. Right, it's now time for a message from One Voice, and don't forget that you can download a free trial of Media Center Communicator from the digitallifestyle.com downloads, along with other things, including my backup tools and other stuff. And I'll be back with Jason Dunn.
Introducing Media Center Communicator, the perfect complement for Windows Media Center. Imagine walking into your home and simply speaking to play music, watch TV, read and send email, call to order pizza, and more. Now with Media Center Communicator, you have full control of your digital home using only your voice. And best of all, there is no voice training required. And built on OneVoice's Media Center Communicator, MC Each Speech Tools is a powerful speech recognition toolkit allowing developers of Media Center compatible applications to easily incorporate speech recognition commands as features. OneVoice offers licenses for MCE speech tools along with its Media Center communicator to the rapidly growing community of Media Center developers. Just say it to play it. To learn more, go to www.onev.com.
So, Jason, welcome to the Media Center Show.
Well, thanks, Ian. I'm glad to be here.
You've got a great website, Digital Media Thoughts, and I think we met up at CES, and I mentioned to you then that it's probably one of the RSS feeds that I've had the longest in my list, and it's a site I've been reading for quite a few years. So I thought we were going to talk today a bit about Digital Media Thoughts and your interest in Media Center and some of your thoughts on Media Center that we've discussed in the past about album art issues and things like that. So we'll delve into that. So first, you give us a background on you and how you got started with Digital Media Thoughts.
Digital Media Thoughts was sort of the third website that I'd actually launched. Going back a little bit in time, back to the late 90s, I was really involved with Microsoft's Windows CE, and they had the little handheld HPCs, the clamshell machines. I got really involved there. That's actually when I became an MVP in 1997. And then sort of fast forward a few more years, I was involved with the products, and I started talking to Microsoft, marketing people, and then eventually I started actually doing some writing for them, some paid writing, and then I launched a Pocket PC Thoughts in 2000, and then that sort of evolved into a, when your hobbies start costing you money, you need to decide if they're going to be a hobby or if they're going to be a business. And I essentially decided to turn Pocket PC Thoughts into a business, and then a couple years later, sort of Thoughts Media was born when I launched Smartphone Thoughts, and then Digital Media Thoughts was sort of the third site. And then, of course, now I have Zune Thoughts, and this is essentially what I do full-time for a living. So Digital Media Thoughts was our sort of our third site. It was the most broadly focused site, which, to be frank, has been a slight detriment because I love everything to do with digital media, whether it's audio or video or photo, and I sort of assumed that everyone else out there loved exactly the same thing, but the reality is most people are sort of more interested in photography, or they're sort of more into the video, and so we've had a bit of a hard time sort of finding our footing in terms of getting a big audience. We certainly have a core group of readers. Thankfully, you're one of them, but it's always interesting when you launch a new website, really trying to find your audience. And later this year, we're actually going to be changing our focus a little bit and actually focusing a little bit more on sort of digital media topics sort of in and around the home, so more specifically Media Center stuff, and we're going to sort of drop some of the more broader termed stuff that we're covering, and there may even be a slight name change in there somewhere too.
Yeah, so I suppose when you've got a broad market, you tend not to get the sort of a hardcore group of followers. Whereas, I suppose like Pocket PC Thoughts, you've got dedicated Pocket PC fans that sort of congregate on the site. But when you've got a broader area, it's hard to sort of get that that same following.
Yeah, and that's something that I've learned over the years in doing this. As I've launched, we have four sites, and there are websites out there that are about a specific product, so widget XYZ, and they have a website about that can quickly become very tired if there isn't a lot of innovation and new stuff coming out. The next level above that is when you launch a website about sort of a platform, and that's what sort of Pocket PC Thoughts and Smartphone Thoughts are covering right now, where there's a good mix of you get the really passionate, really interested people. But then you also get, you have a lot of stuff to talk about because there's software, there's hardware, there's accessories. And then the next step above that is what I guess I'd almost call a concept. And that's where Digital Media Thoughts is, where we're sort of covering the idea of digital audio, video, photo kind of stuff. And that's where it becomes a little bit harder to kind of nail down a core audience because it is such a broad. I mean, it's sort of like me launching Computer Thoughts and saying, I'm going to cover everything to do with computers. And that would, of course, would be ludicrous, but only slightly less ludicrous was what we were trying to do with Digital Media Thoughts. So it's been a challenge, but I really, really enjoy the kinds of topics that we cover.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you get the things from lots of digital cameras to MP3 players to Media Center, and you get the whole range of topics on there.
Yeah, so I mean, that's like I said, moving forward this year, we're going to be switching around our focus a little bit. Really, I guess, focusing in on the stuff that people, our audience really seems to care about. Like whenever we post about, you know, digital rights management, that always gets people, you know, talking, network accessible, you know, storage drives, things like Windows Home Server. Those topics people are really interested in. You know, how do I manage, you know, my 30,000 photos and my 20,000 MP3s, and topics like that seem to really resonate with the people that visit our website. So later on this year, we're going to really start to kind of drill down and focus on that type of thing a little bit more. And that's, you know, it's not incidentally, that's something that myself and my other team members are also particularly passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, interesting going on Pocket PC thoughts. You've seen a real change in the devices going back from the early CEDs days going up to Windows Mobile now.
Yeah. The evolution has been very interesting to watch, and it's interesting too how there's been a bit of a I won't call it a throwback because that has a negative sounding tone. But the first, you know, handheld PCs were clamshell devices with keyboards and, you know, grayscale screens. And then what's interesting is you look at some of the new devices coming out now, like the HTC, you know, Advantage, which is sort of a device that has a bigger screen and has a keyboard, and even some of the ultra mobile PCs like the HTC Shift. We're seeing this sort of, you know, interesting hybrid of making laptops as small as possible, and a lot of the functionality gets them back to what the HPCs were in the initial days. Of course, you know, color screens and Windows Vista and lots of things have changed, but that desire, I think, to find the perfect mobile device for, you know, individual scenarios, that hasn't changed. And we see people just throwing all sorts of interesting designs out there.
Yeah, I mean, I had one of the first color Windows CE devices, and it was a compact one. It was a great device at the time. And, you know, the kind of usefulness of these devices, you know, I'm going up to a Trio now, it's still there, but the technology's evolved, but, you know, the devices have still got the same sort of appeal, like you said, of, you know, carrying your data around and sort of having a PC in your pocket.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? That, like you said, the devices have changed, the technology has changed. What hasn't changed, though, is the people's, you know, a person's desire to have their stuff with them. What's interesting, though, you know, looking back over the past 10 years, the number of people that all of a sudden want to have their data with them, whether that's Outlook data or email or just a simple phone list, that number has certainly grown by leaps and bounds, right? I mean, thinking back a decade ago, you know, most people were kind of just starting to use email, you know, on a regular basis. And certainly nowadays, if you were to say, okay, you know, if I were to take away, you know, your email and your contact list and your digital calendar, you know, would you be able to function? And more and more people would probably not be able to live very effectively.
The progress has been good, but I think, like you said, the attitudes have also changed. People carrying, you know, their email around and everything else. It is back to the vision of something I wanted sort of back in '97. You wanted everything, and you wanted this powerful PC to carry around with you. And it's kind of just coming right now with the way we've got data connections on the mobile devices.
Yeah, it's funny, right? I remember, you know, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, everyone kept talking about, you know, the data is going to be in the cloud and it's going to be high speed and you don't really need local storage. And, you know, fast forward 7 or 8 odd years later, and that's still not very realistic. You know, I mean, the vast majority of, I mean, the North American market for sure, you know, still has a lot of slower data rates. The data packages are just absurd. And my blood boils every time I think about how much my local cell phone carrier, you know, wants to charge me, you know, for 3 megabytes of data. It's just ludicrous. Certainly in Europe, things are definitely better with a lot of 3G technologies, but that nirvana of being always connected with a high-speed device that won't die on you after a day's use, that is still out there in the future somewhere.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the sort of the thing with the UMPCs. I kind of almost get the same feeling behind the sort of the whole UMPC buzz that you get back with you know, the original Windows CE devices. I've got a Sony Q1, a Samsung Q1, and I really love that device. I'm sort of carrying it around with me all the time, and it almost takes me back to '97 of getting the first Pocket PCs and carrying those around with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating. You know, the devices like we'd mentioned, They can do so much more now. But again, you know, so for me, the UMPC, I was really, really excited about it. But then, you know, again, the reality didn't quite meet, you know, the hype. What I would pay for, you know, would be a device that actually would last a day or even, you know, a couple of days of relatively heavy use, was, you know, kind of light and thin. And, you know, the reality is the first generation devices we got, you know, only a few hours of battery life, kind of chunky, fairly expensive. And the promise is there, but that technology still, you know, needs to evolve. And so I find myself just sort of making do with my little 10.6 inch Fujitsu laptop, because that sort of is small enough to be relatively portable, but it's big enough and it has, you know, battery life of over 10 hours. And so that's what I still use. But the UMPC, you know, very, very interesting promise.
And the progress that sort of been made with those devices kind of mirrored with sort of Media Center and what we're talking about today. You know, we're going back from the first editions of Media Center and pre-Media Center, when you were trying to stick TV cards in your PC. We've sort of got today to the much more evolved and stable platform. So when did you first get into Media Center?
Excellent question. I mean, I have a long history of, you know, wanting to, you know, digitize and work with media on a computer. I mean, I can remember, you know, I don't even know when the heck this was. This was going back to probably, you know, the mid-90s. I remember buying a Matrox Rainbow Runner, and it was this sort of video card that had this motion JPEG capture sort of daughter card that you would kind of snap onto it, and I would, you know, transfer VHS tapes, you know, onto my computer. And, you know, I remember doing like a friend's wedding video and having to go out and buy like I think it was an 18 gig hard drive, and it cost me like $900 or some horrible amount. So I go way back there, you know, to the early era, of, you know, working with all sorts of digital content. To be honest with you, I didn't really get into the first generation of Media Center. I want to say that the second gen was when I sort of got my first computer that actually had it. I mean, I should clarify, as an MVP, right? You know, I have access to the MSDN stuff, and so that gave me the ability to actually test out Media Center, because I think back in that generation, it was very difficult to actually find the software on its own, because I don't think Microsoft was selling OEM versions, right? So the only way you could get it was if you bought, you know, an HP unit. And I tend to always want to build my own computers, so buying, you know, a Media Center computer was not terribly exciting. And then also being in Canada, there was problems with, you know, it just simply not being supported here.
I think most people's introduction to Media Center was through MSDN. It certainly was for me, and just prior to the UK launch, it was available on there, and it was, you know, it was pretty exciting to get into that. So what made you, like you said, you mentioned you go into transferring your data across. Was it the TV aspect that excited you about Media Center, or was it the whole sort of the digital media, your pictures and your music and your videos and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I would say probably it was the TV aspect that probably pulled me in sooner. Being where I am in Canada, you know, we don't have TiVos here, right? So, you know, you heard about the TiVo in the U.S., but you couldn't buy it here. And I think I remember buying a Replay TV, I believe, off of eBay, you know, sort of a TiVo competitor. Oh gosh, it's got to be at least 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago now, I'm kind of guessing. But I got that and kind of set it up, and of course the whole process was just ridiculous, because I'm setting it up and I couldn't even select any locations in Canada. I had to select the closest location to me on, you know, kind of my vertical time zone, which was, I think, Helena, Montana. You know, so I'm trying to get this thing set up, and then of course I didn't have any downloadable TV guide information because I'm in Canada, so I had to basically use it as a dumb VCR and actually manually program in all the TV shows. That lasted for a little while, but it was just, you know, really frustrating. And then I think I went to I got a Hoppage TV tuner card, and I used Beyond TV, the SnapStream product. And that was sort of my first experience with sort of a real, you know, TV guide like atmosphere, being able to record TV shows. And but then I sort of didn't like how it was just limited to TV, and that was when I sort of started looking at the Media Center side of things. And there's still a lot of things that the SnapStreams product actually does really well. And I keep wishing I could sort of have a hybrid between the two, because there's many things about Media Center that just drive me bonkers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that we're going to cover. So you were sort of, your initial use then was with an XP. So how long did you have XP? You must have had, what, say, a couple of years of XP. Then how long have you been on Vista?
So I was using basically Windows Media Center 2005 was really the first version, I would say, that I got deep into, and was using it, 100% of the time. And yeah, so I would have used that for a couple of years. Like I had a shuttle computer that I had, configured, that had my TV tuner card. Happily used that for quite some time. And then I guess the Vista Media Center, actually my first experience with Vista Media Center, in terms of owning it, would have been with the Velocity microcomputer that Microsoft had sent out to some of the bloggers. Some of them got the Ferrari laptops. They sent me the Velocity microcomputer. So that was really my first Vista Media Center experience.
And one of the things you've been quite vocal about is the fact that some of the features in Vista are almost like a backward step on XP. So what are your issues with the Vista?
Well, I mean, certainly it is a lot better in a lot of ways. Some ways not. I mean, one thing I since I'm vocal about some of the ways it's not so good, I want to be equally vocal about the ways it is good. One of the very painful parts, and I'm sure you can sympathize with this, is that the Media Center 2005, So pre-Vista, it didn't come with, kind of an MPEG-2 codec that allowed it to do the DVD burning. And I shouldn't say it's not really a codec issue, but basically the software guts for DVD burning of video weren't actually included in there. And, Microsoft's response was, well, any OEM that's going to ship this product is all, is going to essentially buy the software bits from Sonic, right? It was the Sonic encoder. So is this ringing any bells with you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right. So for people that maybe didn't go through this pain, the long and the short of it was that, Sonic had this product, but when Media Center 2005 came out, I think they essentially kind of discontinued selling the product. And so anyone that was building their own Media Center using the OEM version of Windows Media Center essentially had a Media Center that couldn't, burn video DVDs, unless you went out and downloaded like an illegal version of the software, which was just a horrible, horrible scenario that Microsoft and Sonic, kind of put the enthusiasts in. Much to my dismay, that's exactly what I did. I literally could not find a way to burn video DVDs from within Media Center until I found like the Sonic encoder on some random website, because they wouldn't even sell it to me, right? And I even contacted them directly to try to find a solution to this problem, and their response was, well, anyone that's building a Media Center is already licensing our product, so we're not going to sell it to the end user. And I bought a 17-inch Fujitsu Media Center laptop. It did not have that encoder. I could not burn video DVDs with a commercial, laptop that was supposedly had this software. So, did you go through any of that, Ian? Was that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was one of the key things of when you were setting up your own Media Center. There were two issues, wasn't there? There was the DVD encoder software, decoder software, and then there was the actual MPEG decoder software. So you had to go and purchase CyberLink or one of the other DVD decoders, because out of the box, you couldn't watch TV and you couldn't watch DVD.
Yeah. So it was just a horribly, horribly broken scenario. Now, much to Microsoft's credit, the Vista, out-of-box solution is much, much nicer now. You can install Vista, and of course now with it being included in the home premium and the ultimate SKUs, it's very easy to simply fire up Media Center, watch the DVD, burn it. So that's great. One of the things that I find frustrating with the current version of Media Center on Vista, and a lot of this I think is just related to Vista itself and drivers and all these other things, but I have a really hard time actually with performance issues on this Velocity Micro computer that I have. Specifically, anytime there's an overlay, so when you bring up, you adjust the volume, and it brings up the volume overlay, my frames per second of the video I'm watching drop down to about 4 frames per second. It's like the whole thing just, you know, sputters and grinds to a halt. And I've got this Velocity microcomputer, you know, with a decent video card and a fast CPU and lots of RAM, and it just drags. So I haven't done a lot of research to find out if other people are seeing it. Have you encountered anything similar to that?
No, absolutely not. No, the media center PC that I've got is my own build that was running XP before, and I have no performance issues at all. I did see some issues on a similar thing with the Ferrari laptop, with some of the sort of the, it struggled with some of the playback, but on my own machines, I've had no issues with that. So I think it must be a combination of video drivers. And I mean, in fact, even if you take something like the Samsung Q1, which is, you know, running the Pentium M, that has no problems with overlays or playing video data, whereas the Ferrari 1000 does seem to have a problem. So I guess it's just on how those are built and drivers, because certainly Q1 is no sort of powerhouse, but has no problems at all playing recorded TV or, you know, any other kind of video files.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and again, this is why I sort of preface my complaint with, I don't think it's Media Center itself. I think it's a deeper Vista issue with the drivers. But from an end user perspective, right, when I went from Media Center 2005 in, you know, kind of November of last year was when I was using it, and then when I got the Velocity Micro and I started using it, the experience of going from Media Center 2005 up to the Vista Media Center, that particular issue has just, you know, it's kind of embarrassing. I don't even really want to show my friends, you know, how it's working, because it just, it drags and it sputters and it's particularly brutal. So I'm hoping that as Vista video drivers improve and, you know, as different low level Vista things, the performance is enhanced, I'm hoping that issues like this will actually disappear.
I mean, on the subject of video drivers, how have you found NVIDIA and ATI's response to Vista and their, you know, the speed that they brought drivers out? Because it seems to me that NVIDIA have been pretty slow in bringing out drivers for Vista.
Yeah, I mean, certainly anytime you have, NVIDIA cards, you know, being sold at retail, you know, like partner cards that have, you know, designed for Vista on the box, and then, you know, someone brings it home, and because for the first couple months, I believe, you know, you couldn't get, you know, NVIDIA cards to work in SLI mode, and there was just, you know, huge uproar. I remember reading about, you know, class action suits that people were going to file against NVIDIA. So certainly there's a lot of consumers out there that were very, very frustrated with the driver response. I would say on the whole, I've been fairly disappointed with the speed at which, hardware and software vendors have been releasing, you know, Vista versions. I mean, certainly, you know, the first couple of weeks, yeah, I can understand them, you know, maybe not having an out, but, you know, 4 or 5 months down the road, which where we are now, you know, I mean, I just got my HP color laser jet printer working, I think about a month ago, because for the longest time, I literally could not print to this brand new, I bought the printer just about, you know, 8 months ago, and I couldn't print to this printer because there was no Vista drivers. So certainly operating system upgrades are immensely painful. I was disappointed, yeah, with both ATI and NVIDIA. I had a machine that was running an ATI video card, and it kept, you know, blue screening and crashing and dying, and I did a bit of research, and a particular version of ATI's driver actually was causing this blue screen, like essentially almost every single time you booted your computer. So it's really a minefield, I think, for the average person to go through, and which, as of right now, I'm still not really strongly recommending Vista to anyone unless I know that they're sort of technical enough to kind of work through the glitches and some of the frustrations.
But I've certainly found that, you know, if you buy a new machine and the Vista pre-installed, there seems to be no major issues on that. And like you said, an enthusiast crowd are going to have no major issues. But, you know, if you've got a machine that you with someone that's, you know, not a sort of a hardcore enthusiast, or even not a, you know, just keen on the subject of sort of getting drivers and things like that, then it is probably as well to leave XP as it is, because the problem is, of course, with XP it does work and to quite a good standard, so it doesn't seem worth the risk for a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the unfortunate reality, right, is that everyone has been sort of, you know, trained over the years to think of their computers as being upgradable. And to be fair, you know, they are and they should be upgradable, you know, because there was, you know, there was people that went out, you know, they were running Windows 2000 and they upgraded to XP and everything, you know, sort of continued to work more or less properly. But just somehow this upgrade to Vista is just, it seems, in my mind, and maybe I'm just, you know, forgetting how painful XP was initially, but in my mind, Vista seems to be much more painful. You know, if you had a computer that was running XP and you wipe it out and you install Vista and you sort of expect things to work, sometimes it works great, but there's just all these little niggles where, yeah, to back to your earlier point, for the most part, I would just recommend that someone just simply go and purchase a Vista computer and they will probably have a much better experience.
Well, one thing I did find when I upgraded mine back in January was the fact that just a bit of research beforehand can help, you know, look at the cards that you've got. Certainly the TV tuner card that I was using, I knew before I even touched, you know, wouldn't work. And so, you know, I checked around on the forums and people commented on the blog, you know, with some recommendations for the tuner card. So I got a new one and that worked absolutely brilliantly from day one. So, you know, that is one thing you can certainly do is a bit of research and find out what you've got and find out what works well via the forums and the blogs and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit of upfront legwork can certainly decrease the amount of pain you feel. And interestingly enough, in some ways, I mean, so I've installed Vista on every computer I have, so I guess it's about six computers, including my wife's. And what's interesting is that Vista works almost better on some of the older hardware, which is quite interesting because a lot of it just simply relies on Microsoft's sort of, you know, default drivers. Whereas I think you run into a lot of issues where you actually, in fact, I've seen, you know, more problems upgrading, you know, to the latest, you know, NVIDIA or ATI drivers or whatever. Whereas if you just sort of stick with some of the default Microsoft ones, they're not very high performance, but in general they seem to be more stable. And I'm hoping, you know, kind of by the end of this year that difference won't really be there, you know, and that the video card drivers will actually be more mature and you'll be able to get, you know, performance and stability.
Yeah. Yeah, good point there, actually, because that's maybe one of the issues with the Q1, which is using the default driver for the Intel 915 chipset, and, you know, that's been well developed for, you know, because it's not a moving target, and the newer devices that, like you said, you know, things are changing all the time, and then that where the stability decreases.
Yeah, because, you know, optimizing for speed is always a tricky thing. I mean, I've, you know, one of the contributing editors on Digital Media Thoughts, he was getting some parts, you know, motherboard, AMD CPU, you know, and a hard drive, and was, you know, putting together this system. He was actually, I think, one of his projects was to build a completely silent system. And he just ended up having a huge number of nightmare issues, and there was some sort of bizarre NVIDIA, you know, motherboard with an NVIDIA chipset and some sort of a serial ATA problem with the drivers, and it just was a nightmare. And it somehow, I mean, this almost sounds hard to believe, but it ended up actually burning out the hard drive. You had a 750 gig hard drive from Seagate, and somehow this particular setup, it actually like just smoked the hard drive and just destroyed it. So, you know, it's one of these things where right now the enthusiast that's wanting to put together a high performance machine, that I think they are the biggest. The odds of them running into painful parts of you know, building a high-end performance machine with Vista right now, they're probably the ones that are going to run into the most problems because, again, there's just all these little driver issues that they're trying to work out that, for the moment, can be quite painful.
Yeah, so what you mean. So it pays to do your research if you're going to do any self-builds to find out, you know, the experience see the other people's problems that they've got and to learn from those.
Yeah, or just buy a Dell. That's what I keep swearing to myself every time I build a computer and something blows up or doesn't work. I say, I just should have bought a Dell, you know. But
I mean, that's an interesting sort of debate, isn't it? That, especially for the enthusiasts, the off the shelf or the Dell type thing versus, you know, building your own. You build your own, you know what you get in, you know what you can upgrade. Whereas you buy a pre-built machine and, you know, it just arrives and works, and you haven't got the same headaches. So what's your thoughts on that? You think it's worth enthusiastic sort of putting the time in to build their own machines?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think For the enthusiast, you know, kind of the battle is part of their joy. You know, when you assemble something and it just works, I mean, there's a certain amount of satisfaction in that, but there's also a certain amount of satisfaction in, you know, trying to overclock it and trying to tweak settings, you know, and really just sort of making it as high performance as possible. Enthusiasts, you know, like myself, you know, we enjoy that kind of thing, but interestingly enough, I find as I get older, I'm in my early 30s right now, as I get older, I sort of just want things to work, you know, a bit more often than I did, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, where I would have enjoyed it. Now, you know, I'm so busy. When I build a computer, well, damn it, I want it to work. I don't want it to blue screen. I don't want it to, you know, crash on me. I just want it to work. So, there's still a lot of value in enthusiasts doing that, because certainly most major manufacturers still aren't giving enthusiasts enough choice in terms of the hardware and the configurations and just sort of the general things. Although that said, I just ordered a really sweet new Dell laptop that I'm particularly excited about getting. It's my first Dell laptop I've ever ordered. So
I suppose that's where you don't do self-built laptops, so that's where these things come pre-configured, and there is no sort of room for tinkering with those, and it is, you know, like they just worked on it.
Yeah, exactly. Although interestingly enough, a couple months ago I read an article in Maximum PC. It's the only magazine I subscribe to, and they actually had a self-built laptop. So there's a couple of companies out there that actually sell laptop kits that are essentially an LCD screen and sort of an empty chassis, and then you sort of would pick the motherboard, and then you actually install the CPU and the RAM and the hard drive. And I mean, to me, that just seems a bit too torturous, because when it comes to laptops, yeah, I really just want it to work. You know, I really don't want to have to crack it open and upgrade all sorts of parts. So.
No, absolutely, you don't want to be worrying about the heat sinks and things like that on a laptop, because all these things, they're just really too small to fiddle around with.
Yeah, and laptops in particular are designed by, you know, usually smart engineers that, you know, integrate the components, and everything, you know, is really just kind of on the head of a pin in terms of being, well, you know, we've made this thing go about as hot and as fast as we can, and if we, you know, put in a faster hard drive, it's going to, you know, bump the temperature up by 5 degrees, and then stuff's going to start to fail, you know. So laptops are very precisely engineered, I think, much more so than the average desktop, you know, where you can swap parts in and out, and as long as you have a power supply that's sufficient, you know, you're pretty much in good shape.
Yeah, especially if you've seen the wiring inside of my one of my media center PCs that myself built. It's not exactly what you could call structured.
a little bit hairy, is it?
Yeah, everything's thrown in there, TV cards and loads of hard drives and everything, and I would say that the cables are structured in the best way they could be. It's kind of thrown in over time.
Right.
So I know one thing that we talked about sort of via email, and I mentioned on the blog a few times, is the issue with album art, and I know this is sort of when you're your pet hate. So what is your issue with that?
Well, album art to me is really important. I'm a very visual person, and when I think of my CD collection, I sort of think of it in terms of, you know, what does the cover art look like, because that seems to be usually the only thing I can really remember very easily. So to me, album art is really important. Now, Microsoft's approach to album art has been very kind of fragmented, and it seems almost a bit like an afterthought. So if you could imagine let's say with like a JPEG image, right, you have the EXIF data, all the data related to the photo, when it was taken, what kind of camera it was and whatnot. If Microsoft approached that the way they approached album art, you know, you would end up with a little, you know, XML file right next to the JPEG file, and you'd have an individual XML file for every single JPEG. And, you know, essentially the metadata and the actual data would be two separate files, because that's essentially the way that Microsoft has approached the issue of album art. Now, to be fair, one of the reasons that they've done this, or one of the reasons they did this, you know, kind of in the past, was that certain MP3 players, and especially like car decks and things like that play MP3s and WMAs, if the header, which essentially is where the album art is stored, so the header is, you know, just kind of the top part of the data file there, if the header was too big a lot of players actually just simply wouldn't play the file. So I think years ago they had to take this approach where, okay, if we want to do Alt-Mart, we have to have it stored as a separate, you know, separate file, which again years ago might have made sense, but now things have evolved to the point where, I mean, I haven't run across any type of device that couldn't play, you know, an MP3 file with my embedded Alt-Mart in it. Yet Microsoft still sort of clings to this old approach where they have Alt-Mart, you know, separated out. Now most people don't realize this unless they go in and actually turn on, you know, hidden files, and I think you also have to turn off the hide protected files. And then if you look at a directory in an album, you'll actually see, you know, several files. Like there'll be, you know, a picture or a folder done JPEG, there'll be a big Alt-Mart, a small Alt-Mart, and then there'll be a couple other associated files. So this first became really irritating to me when I was using a product called FolderShare, which was purchased by Microsoft last year. And FolderShare allows you to essentially synchronize two folders. Now, what it did, though, it had a nasty habit of it would unhide all of the files in a folder. So what would happen is my music folder would synchronize over with a few albums, and I would see all of this refuse. I would see all this album art and these, you know, INI files and just all this kind of junk, and it became kind of a real source of frustration for me. And then as I did a bit more research and I kind of started to figure out, you know, why Microsoft did things the way that they were doing them, it just has become, you know, very, very frustrating. Now, where we are today with album art is Vista, quite thankfully, is actually fairly sophisticated insofar as it will actually render album art that is embedded inside a file. So if you have embedded album art, like, you know, inside an MP3 or WMA, and you just have that single file, when it renders the thumbnail, it'll actually render the album art. So that's a beautiful, awesome thing. But it's still very fragmented across the whole platform. So if you don't have album art in the folder, okay, and Windows Media Center goes to scan, you know, and you're basically listening to the music in Windows Media Center, it's supposed to read the embedded album art as sort of the second option. So if I can't find album art in the folder, it reads it out of the file. But that's quite glitchy because every single time that I listen to an album that has embedded album art, the first time I listen to the song, I get the generic no album art found. If I skip to song 2, it will render the embedded album art. And then if I skip back to song 1, it will usually render the embedded album art. So there's just a ton of glitches there. And then when you factor in the Zune, it becomes a whole new headache because the Zune will forcibly resize all your album art to 320 by 320, even if you don't want it to. And yeah, I'm kind of rambling at this point, but the basic problem is that Microsoft, it seems like no one there really thinks or cares about album art, and their approach to it has been fairly just chaotic and sloppy.
And it's one of the key things, isn't it, that with Media Center and Vista Media Center, one of the key features around the music is the thumbnails, and it's basically driven around the image work rather than the titles as it was in XP. And then when you're actually playing an album, I've noticed that, you know, when you watch it on a 50-inch LCD, the actual quality of the image of the album cover is pretty poor, and you can see the artifacts on it, and it, you know, certainly you lose that kind of high-def experience that you're expecting to see with Media Center.
Excellent point. The real problem for me that I think makes this whole album art issue painful, the whole issue, you know, with the hidden files and it being kind of sloppy in the folders, that's really just my type A personality. The real issue is the one that you pointed out, is that when you are looking at album art on a big screen, it really ruins the entire effect of the nice, you know, smooth Media Center interface, where you end up with this, you know, 200 by 200, you know, horribly compressed, you know, JPEG album art that just truly looks atrocious. And I don't often compliment Apple, but I will pay them a compliment insofar as they seem to actually get this, because when they redid, you know, on the sub version of iTunes, and they started to pull down album art, it's all, you know, 600 by 600 pixel. It's not very compressed, you know, so the quality is quite high. And they seem to understand that album art is important when you're doing, like, their cover flow, or even when you're using the Apple TV. So I don't know who at Microsoft doesn't understand that album art quality is actually an important thing, and especially for anyone that's visually oriented, it really does matter. Yet I've been pursuing this issue for probably 2 years now, and I've never really found anyone at Microsoft that truly wants to carry the torch and make the experience of album art better.
Mm, I mean, I suppose when you're looking at album art through Windows Media Player on a 2-foot desktop, you know, that's, you know, the small 200 by 200 is not really an issue, and you know, you minimize it and carry on working. But it takes on a whole new meaning when you switch to Media Center and it's on a 50-inch screen. You know, that's where it makes a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have, in my office, I have a 26-inch Dell LCD TV that I have hooked up to my Media Center, and even just on a 26-inch TV, the album art looks, you know, atrocious. And I mean, and part of that's because the TV's smaller. I'm viewing it, you know, from maybe, you know, 5 or 6 feet away as opposed to maybe 10 feet away. But you know, the reality is that I don't think anyone can look at the quality of the album art coming down, you know, from Microsoft's partners and really say that's a good experience. But the more painful part for me is, and here, this will, for anyone listening, this will really explain how my personality works. I so wanted to have a high quality album art experience that my wife and I actually sat down and scanned about 750 CDs. So we actually scanned the album art from the CDs I owned. I, you know, retouched and resized all of them just so I could have a really awesome album art experience. But then I ran into all these bizarre snags where, you know, even though I had the album art embedded in the file, most Microsoft software will look at the album art in the folder. It will actually ignore the high-quality embedded album art, and it will look at the file in the folder, because apparently that's they made that decision for performance issues, because so it's faster for them to read the album art out of the folder. Now, computers have, you know, they're always getting faster, and I find it really hard to believe that it would be that much of a performance hit to just read the album art out of the file.
Yeah, so what you mean. I mean, I know that one of the features of going back to CES last year was that, you know, Vista, the music in Media Center would be improved in terms of performance. So maybe that's one of the issues where they did that. It was because that was a complaint with XP when you had a large library that, you know, it was slow to go through your music library. So maybe that's why in Vista that they took that route. But I see what you're saying. You know, as machines are getting more and more powerful all the time, you only have to look at, you know, some of the DirectX 10 stuff. You know, things are moving on, and it should at least perhaps be an option.
Yeah, and I think ultimately this underscores a fairly long-term problem that Microsoft has, is they tend to be more reactionary than visionary. You know, the visionary approach would have been, you know, really with Vista, or maybe even slightly sooner, to say, okay, you know, we're going to rethink album art. We're going to, you know, start to prep our channel partners to get, you know, 1,000 by 1,000 pixel resolution, you know, album art, you know, something nice and big. We're going to think ahead, you know, to 80-inch, you know, 1080p screens. We're going to really make sure that the album art experience is totally top notch. But instead, they're reactionary, and I would guess probably sometime next year, the year after, maybe some of this stuff will sort of start to be fixed, and it'll be, you know, several years too late. And if there's one thing I could wish for Microsoft to be, it would be more, less reactionary and more proactive with things like this.
Yeah, and I suppose, and that's the case of, it's not only changing the way the software works, but also, like you said, the partners, the data providers to update their data as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's certainly part of the puzzle for the majority of people, because the majority of people are not going to do what I did. They're not going to scan their album art. But there's also a lot of websites out there that actually have high quality album art for downloading. Well, in fact, what I did, if anyone wants to go to jasondunn.com and they look down the sidebar, I actually put up all 700 and whatever of my album art. In fact, I need to update it because I just realized I'm slightly over 800 CDs now. And so I think last time I checked, there's about 15 or 18 gigs of monthly traffic of people coming and just simply downloading the high quality album art. So I know that there's demand out there for this. People, visual people, they do. They want to see the good, high-quality album art. And Microsoft is just ignoring it completely. And I wish someone would care about it other than you and I.
I mean, we just hope that it does get picked up by someone and sort of put into a future release.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the tweaks that they would need to do are actually not all that significant. I think that, you know, it really wouldn't be all that difficult for someone to release like a, even Microsoft to release like a power toy or something that would, you know, maybe hit Amazon.com or some of these other services and just sort of start to snag high quality album art and just sort of download it and embed it into the files. And I think certainly, I think at the very least, Microsoft should update their software so that it looks for embedded album art first and folder album art second. So for all the music enthusiasts that really do care about their album art and the music enthusiasts that have gone through the work of embedding their album art, those people will at least get a top-notch experience and the rest of the world can kind of catch up slowly.
How long did it take to scan 700 album covers then? Because like, that's a big job, sure.
Yes. I freely admit it's rather maniacal and most normal human beings would not do that. we did it like in batches, you know, so I'd bring down, you know, a dozen CDs and my wife would scan them in and then I would, crop and, you know, straighten them and just sort of make sure that they would look good. And then now it's obviously much easier because, you know, if I go out and I buy three or four CDs, you know, it only takes me a couple minutes to do. But, you know, again, this is one of these things where nobody else was doing this for me. Like, I searched and searched and searched and could not find any music provider out there, and even Amazon. I mean, some other stuff was 600 by 600, which looked good, but most of it was still, you know, 200 by 200. And I just could not find anyone out there that actually had, you know, good quality album art. And so I just kind of did my own solution. And it was grunt work. It took a lot of time. I think the whole project went over, I think, about a six-month period.
And has it made a big difference then, aside from the Zune issue, which we'll come back to, but once you've got them embedded in there, have you managed to get sort of MIDI Center to look good now you've done that?
Again, with the exception of the bizarre bug where you look at the first song and it's blank and then you go into the second song and it loads it. When it does load my album art and I can see it, it is honestly, it's jaw dropping, you know, cause like on a nice high resolution monitor, good crisp album art that is, you know, not too compressed. And I mean, it looks totally fantastic. I definitely do feel it was worth the effort. On the flip side though, it's really frustrating to know that I went through all the work to do this and then to be sort of sabotaged by some of the software where, you know, I load up an album and it gives me that generic no album art, and I know 100% for sure that the album art is really there. It's just some obscure Microsoft bug that's not showing it to me.
And you mentioned about the Zune causing an issue, and I think we talked about it in the past. So what's the problem when you use the Zune player that it resizes the album art?
Yeah, so this took just a lot of research to try to figure out what it does. Because I run Zune Thoughts, you know, I'm trying to be an expert on all things Zune. With one product, it's not that hard, but the desktop software is a bit of a puzzle to figure out. At first, I thought that the Zune actually displayed embedded album art, because I emailed a song to a friend of mine that worked at Microsoft that had a Zune, like a pre-release Zune. I sent him an MP3 file, like a small sample that had embedded album art, and said, hey, put this on your Zune and tell me if the album art shows up. And he sent me a picture of the album art showing up, and I was just elated. I thought, oh my god, Microsoft finally figured it out. They finally got it right. There's finally a music player on the market that will read embedded album art. This is the way it should be. I thought it was a miracle. Well, it turned out to be completely false. It was a false scenario, because what the Zune software does is when it scans your library, okay, it will pull out the embedded album art. So I embed 600 by 600 JPEGs as album art. It will pull out the album art. It will resize it to 240 by 240, and it will compress it. My testing tells me it compresses it as a JPEG at around a 50 to 60% quality. So what you end up with is a small, highly compressed JPEG that just looks bad. Now, to give the Zune team credit, when they first released it, it was converting it at 200 by 200. And the Zune screen is 240 pixels wide, so it was actually taking that 200 by 200 JPEG and stretching it, which made it look even worse. So by making it 240 by 240, it looks a little bit better, but the JPEG compression is what's killing it. And again, there's some developer somewhere that set the JPEG compression ratio, right? Like, there's some guy in Microsoft that said, oh, well, because we want to conserve space, we're going to make it, you know, 60%. We're going to just crush the quality, and all we want to do is save space. So there's some guy somewhere that set up that parameter. But I can't find anyone at Microsoft to maybe tell me how to change it. I can't find it with a registry hack. I mean, I don't know of any way of actually forcing the software to not compress the JPEG so brutally.
Mm. And have you found the Zoom player that overall, because they're not available in the UK, and I saw them in CES, but I have no experience with the devices, but you know, how have you found yours?
Overall, I like it. I mean, I think in a lot of ways you can look at the Zoom and you can kind of see that it was rushed to market. I think that if Microsoft would have waited 6 more months and really put more effort into the development part, because I mean, really what they did was they went to Toshiba and said, okay, we need to make an MP3 player, we want it to have Wi-Fi, you know, what off-the-shelf designs do you have? And Toshiba basically handed them and said, here you go. I'm simplifying, of course, but that's really essentially what it comes down to. So the Zoom player was rushed in a lot of ways. I mean, it has some great things. I mean, it's got this, you know, this great, you know, a big, beautiful screen, you know, decent resolution. It's a good player, but then it's been crippled in all these really bizarre ways. So just as an example, Microsoft puts out this player that's almost twice as thick as an iPod, okay? So you're not going to sell it to people that are really interested in a svelte, you know, pocketable device. You're going to sell to people that are interested in that big, bright screen, and they're going to want to use that big, bright screen for more than just music, right? So they're going to want to use it for photos and for videos. What the Zoom team did, though, is, and again, this is a time constraints thing, the Zoom desktop software will not transcode as much video as Windows Media Player does. So, you know, for right now, if you hook up like a portable media center device or whatever, it'll you know, if you have the right codecs installed, it'll transcode DivX files and it'll transcode, you know, the DVR MS files, so you can, you know, you can get your TV shows on your device. None of that stuff works with the Zoom. So the Zoom software cannot transcode DVR MS files. So it can't transcode your TV shows or your movies or anything. It can't transcode DivX files. It can't transcode most things. And so it's incredibly painful that I have this media center. I've got some movies recorded. You know, I'm about to go away on vacation, and I can't load up my Zoom with my own content. You know, it has to be in WMV format. It'll transcode MP4, like an H.264 file, but I don't really have a whole lot of content in that format, so it's not really very helpful to me. So Microsoft, again, they created this product that had a nice, great big screen, but they fell down on the software side. And even with photos, right? Okay, so it's got a nice, big, great big screen. I'm going to want to use it to put some photos on there, and I'm going to want to show people. Well, what do? They resize the photos to VGA resolution, so 640 by 480, which is exactly twice as big as the Zoom screen. The Zoom takes that VGA size photo and it shrinks it down, but it uses a really kind of sloppy resizing algorithm. So edges and corners and fine patterns are all, they just look like crap. Like, they just look really, truly very bad. And so you have the Zoom that you want to use to share pictures, but a lot of your pictures are going to look quite poor on the screen. So there's just these decisions that were made that I just don't think they put enough thought into them, frankly.
And you think that sort of a V2 Zoom, or traditional, the standard joke with Microsoft, isn't it, is always the V3 product that is the one to go for? You think eventually they'll get it right?
Yeah, I really have no doubt. I mean, I certainly, I would not have launched a Zoom website if I believed that the Zoom was a one-off product and that Microsoft was essentially just putting out, you know, one product and they were just going to leave it at that. The Zoom is going to be, calling it a platform is maybe a bit too strong of a term, because you can't develop for the Zoom, and that's typically what the term platform implies. But the Zoom is going to be, you know, a multi-pronged product platform. You know, there's going to be a flash Zoom, there's going to be a bigger hard drive Zoom. You know, we know, I mean, because it's under the Xbox thing, and it's directly under, you know, Jay Allard and Robbie Bach, you know, we know that this is a long-term play for Microsoft. We know that they understand that they can't just let Apple, you know, completely dominate the entire future of, you know, portable digital media. So I have long-term faith in Microsoft when they bunker down and they really put a lot of effort into things. So long term, I have a lot of optimism. Short term, I get very frustrated with the way the Zune is today.
And it just be, you're just looking forward to the new devices. Do you know of any sort of time frames? Are we expecting to see an update this year?
I'm quite confident we will see something this year. It's kind of funny, right? There were so many rumors, you know, swirling around in kind of the February time frame that, oh, there's a new Zune coming out, and people are, quite frankly, a bit delusional. No company, you know, puts out a product and then immediately seeks to replace that product with a new one, because that will utterly alienate their user base, and it's just you know, bad for business, right? I would expect to see sometime in the fall, you know, to kind of holiday time frame of this year, I fully expect to see a flash-based Zune, probably something in the 4 to 8 gig realm. I'm hoping they'll go bigger. I mean, I'm hoping that they will outdo the Nano in terms of storage, but I'm quite certain that we will see a thin, light, flash-based Zune, and I'm equally convinced that we will see a Zune with a bigger hard drive and potentially even a bigger screen and like a higher resolution. So Microsoft isn't dumb. You know, they know that the vast majority of the MP3 players out there are flash-based, you know, because not everyone wants the size and the bulk of a hard drive-based player. So I know for sure that they're working on it. Well, I shouldn't say I know for sure. It's not like I've seen it, but I'm confident they're working on it, and I'm confident that we will see two new Zunes out before the end of this year. But right now, everything else is just there's rumors. You know, there's one is supposedly called Draco, and there's a couple of Zune websites that have speculated quite wildly. But Microsoft has committed long term, and I really like what they've done with the Xbox 360 and the Xbox platform in general. And those are the same people. You know, that's the same, basically, the team. The Zune team is an offshoot of Xbox team members. And so I am confident that they will put out the product that I will really enjoy using later.
Mm. And, of course, the place to keep up with the latest news on that is on Zune Thoughts.
Yeah, that's right. ZuneThoughts.com would be the latest Zune news.
Yeah. Well, it's been great chatting to you today. It's interesting to hear your take on sort of on the XP and Vista, and I'll be interested to see how Digital Media Thoughts changes, and so we'll keep up to date with that, and I'll include a link to all the sites in the show notes as well.
Well, great, thanks. It's been fantastic talking with you. I appreciate the opportunity to share my opinions. It's always a bit easier to talk than it is to write, you know, a 5,000-word article. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely, it's been great, and many thanks for your time today.
All right, thanks, Ian.
Okay, that's it for this week's show. The email address for the show is ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. Don't forget the forums, and you can post about your Essential Media Center applications. I'll see you around next week. Bye.